thanks for downloading the unfiltered version of this episode, and welcome to episode 112. I am so psyched about this episode. I have been wanting to chat with Disney legend Rolly Crump for some time now, and although we weren't able to get together in person, I was super thankful that he and Marie were gracious enough to chat on the phone with me for a while about growing up, working for Walt, working at WED. I even learned that Rolly and I share one of my loves outside of Disney, which was really cool for me. It was a really fun chat that honestly didn't even begin to scratch the surface of things I wanted to bring up, but I wanted to be respectful of Rolly and Marie's time, so I hope I get an opportunity like this again in the future so we can chat about those things a little bit more. Quick note before we jump into the episode, one of the things that I admire so much about Rolly is how candid he is, but while we were talking, there may have been a word or two that some parents listening with their kids may not want them to hear. At the same time, I wanted to be respectful of my conversation with him, so there are two versions of this episode. If you're just getting the straight download, you will be getting a filtered version that will have blips of silence inserted where those words show up. But if you want to listen to or download the unfiltered version, you can get it by going to podcateers.com/112. If you are already listening to that version, then you can just ignore everything I just said in that section, because you probably, you got it already. Support for Podcateers is brought to you by Amazon. Before your next purchase, we would love it if you went to podcateers.com/Amazon first and clicked on the big Amazon button. If you do that, we earn a small commission from that sale, and every bit of that goes back to help the podcast. To everyone already using our link for their purchases, thank you very much for your added support. We truly appreciate it. Another great way to help is to become a patron of our podcast via Patreon. Through Patreon, you can make a one-time, weekly, or monthly monetary contribution to help out the podcast. To find out how or for more information, just go to podcateers.com and click on the Patreon logo. Finally, you can find us on the webs by searching for Podcateers on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, and YouTube. Make sure to like, follow, and subscribe to all of those for updates. That's going to be enough for me. Here we go with episode 112, our chat with Disney legend Rolly Crump. This is our podcast. It's about three guys that love Disney, technology, art, and food. This is Podcateers. Well, hello, okay. Rolly. How are you?
I'm fine, sir. How are you?
I'm well. I was just trying to help my wife get the kids out. She's getting them prepped up for back to school, so they're heading out to buy school supplies and clothes and all that good stuff.
Yeah, all that good stuff was right.
Yeah, so she's about to go deal with a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old at Target, so we'll see how that goes for her.
That keeps your hands full.
Right? How's the heat treating you?
Oh, good.
Life's
been good.
The heat.
The heat. That sucks.
Oh, yeah. You guys are down in Southern California near San Diego, correct?
Yes, right.
Okay. I'm actually a hop, skip, and a jump from where you, I believe, were born in Alhambra, correct?
Right.
So the heat is killing us right now. So growing up, you just like to play around with anything and everything. How would you describe growing up?
Well, I'll tell you what, there's a kind of a cute story about that. I started drawing as soon as I was 3 years old, and I loved to draw. And so my mom made sure that she had pads and pencils for me to draw. And so I enjoyed drawing, but the whole secret was the radio, because I used to listen to the radio every night. I mean, afternoon when I got home from school. And the thing about the radio was your imagination had to get the pictures of what you were listening to. So the radio was a very important part of my life. And it really, really helped me, because it did help me create one hell of a piece of imagination to work with. Mm. So I loved that. And being that the interesting thing about it was I just loved drawing all the time. So I never got tired of drawing. I couldn't wait to do another drawing. So my mom did buy these little tablets for me to draw in, And we still have a couple of them, which is kind of great.
Oh, wow.
And I look back on it, and I thought, shit, I did pretty good.
So there's a pretty famous picture of you and a couple of other Imagineers at WED where you are in top physical condition, sir.
Oh, yes, I was.
Were you a big sports guy growing up?
No, not really. I played basketball in high school. I was on the C team, and I was on the track team, which was the D team. So, yeah, I can't say that there was much in the way of activity in those days. You know what happened was I was kind of a skinny little guy, and for some reason I it's kind of another story about how I started to develop myself. Was I was working on my aunt's farm one summer, and the tractor ran over my leg.
Whoa!
And so it crushed my ankle. So I could hardly walk when I came back. I think I was 14 years old. So the first thing my mom did was sign me up to Vic Tanny's gym. And so I started working out at Vic Tanny's gym to bring my leg back. And I fell madly in love with working out with the weights and all the stuff. And I was really kind of impressed with all that. So I kind of stayed with it.
Yeah, when I saw that picture of you, I thought, wow. If he didn't work at WED, he should have just been a bodybuilder.
I don't know. There was a bunch of us that got together and loved working out, so we had a good time.
So you mentioned your mom signed you up for this gym. How instrumental was your mom, especially in nurturing you as an artist into ultimately what brought you to Disney?
Well, she couldn't have done a better job. My mom supported me and backed me all the time, and I think that's great because a lot of times, if a kid is a little artist, the mom and dad don't necessarily want him to be an artist. They want him to be a lawyer or something, you know. But my mom loved the fact that I liked to draw, and so she supported me 100%. In fact, she got me to go to Chouinard Art School when I was 16.
Wow.
So I went there for six Saturdays when I was 16.
Well, tell him about Wright. She wrote a letter. Oh, yeah.
When I was 16, she wrote a letter to Walt and said that my son was interested in coming to work for you. And I think she got something back from me, whether it was from Walt or not, I don't know. But she did tell me that they did return her little letter or an answer to it.
Yeah, I remember reading about that in your book. It's kind of a cute story.
Good.
It was one of those stories where you just feel like, wow, his mom was just so into this. And like you just said, there's a lot of parents out there that do want their kids to be lawyers or doctors or engineers because that's where the money is. You know, you want to go where the money is.
But we
live in a world right now where you're seeing a lot of younger kids take control of their life and just do what they want to do, really.
Yeah.
They're molding their own futures.
Yeah.
And it's almost, I feel like that's what you did very early on.
Oh, God, yes.
Because of the fact that you had that support system, you really did that from a very young age.
Yeah.
Let's jump a little bit forward here. And before you were working for Disney, you joined WED in 1952, correct?
Right.
And before you were doing that, you were at a factory.
I worked at a ceramic factory. I was the head dipper.
The head dipper at a ceramic
factory.
The
reason I was the head dipper because I was the only dipper.
And I remember reading at one point that when you actually got the offer to go work at Disney, it was a huge pay cut for you moving from the ceramics factory to go to Disney, right?
Yeah, cut me in half. You know, I was making $75 a week in there, and they wanted to hire me at $30 a week.
But it was, again, your mother that was...
Yes. Yeah, I went to my mom because I told her, I said, I don't know whether I can afford to work for Disney. And she said, you've always wanted to work there, honey. She says, go for it, and it'll take care of itself. Because she really believed in that whatever you want to do, you just got to do it. So I did.
And you did. And we're all glad that you did.
Yeah.
So, but you also needed to supplement that with other jobs. Can you describe some of the other work that you did?
Yeah, I worked helping a friend of mine build sewer manholes. And what I did, when they build a manhole, it's just a hole in the ground. And one of the guys has to go down and start mortaring like a chimney. And so my job was to be up above and lower the bricks and mix the mud and lure them all to him. So it was one hell of a job, I'll tell you that.
Okay, so we're starting to get down to the bottom of where most of those mussels came from.
Yeah. I do know that one day we were in a canyon, and we were working so, it was so hot and hard that I actually collapsed.
Oh.
No, a heat stroke got me. And luckily the guys working for went out and got a six-pack of 7-Up and came back and made me drink the whole six-pack. And then I climbed underneath his truck and laid there for the rest of the afternoon. So I did pay my dues.
Yeah, I would say so. All right, so when you were part of Disney, you were originally hired as an in-between artist, and you had a chance to work on some of Disney's most iconic films from that era, including Peter Pan, Lady and the Tramp, 101 Dalmatians, Sleeping Beauty, right. And you assisted Eric Larson. Can you describe a little bit what it was like working with Disney legend Eric Larson?
Well, it was incredible. I mean, he was the sweetest man that was ever put on this earth. And the interesting thing about it is that when I was working on Sleeping Beauty, and he was the art director on Sleeping Beauty, well, the animator I worked for had to always take his scenes once they were made into little prints to look at for the director to look and review all the drawings and the scenes. And he did. He took one of my scenes in that I had done all the cleanups on and everything, and he came back and told me, he said, well, we showed it to Eric and he really wasn't too happy with it. I thought, oh shit, if Eric Larson doesn't like my work, I might as well quit. And so I just took it in stride, and then the next thing I know, a few months later, I've been asked, do you want to work for Eric Larson as his assistant? And I thought, Jesus Christ, how the hell did he pick me to be his assistant when he wasn't too happy with one of the scenes I did? And I never did find out from him about why he picked me.
Oh,
but
we got to be real
close. We became very close.
He must have seen something in you that he really appreciated and admired.
I think he did, yeah. Well, the one thing I do know is I always had a lot of energy. And I know that that's one thing that Walt saw in me, because he told one of the head of the model shop one time, he says, that kid's got a lot of energy. And that was before I even, talked to him. So I think my energy level kind of showed up a little, as well as my imagination,
Were you full of energy when you were a child as well?
Yeah, I was always full of energy.
Because I know there's a lot of parents that see that in their children now, and they think, just sit down. Was that how you were growing up, where you kind of drove your mom nuts with how much energy you had?
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid in school, I ran everywhere. I never walked. I ran, which was to catch the bus or come home from school or whatever. I was constantly running. And that's when I tried out for track. And I ran the 660 for the first time and got up and threw up. And I thought, well, no, I don't want to do that. So I started jumping in the high jump. So I got my letter doing high jumping.
Oh, very cool.
I didn't want to run and get sick again.
I don't blame you. I've been walking a lot because I've had this whole resurgence of being healthy myself, and I don't run at all. It makes me completely sick, so I know exactly what you're saying.
Well, later on, when I was working at WED towards the latter years, when I was in my 50s, a bunch of us decided we'd run after work. So we ran. There was a track. It was a little, where the horses go, a little horse trough of a round that was three miles long or whatever. So we used to go and run every night after work. So I used to love running when I was in my 50s, for God's sake. So
wow.
I did continue on.
Well, maybe in my 50s, I'll like it too. I just know I don't like it now.
Yeah, the good news is I used to run when I was 50. The bad news is I can hardly walk.
So while you were working at WED, and you were part of the animation department, there was a couple of stories that I remember where you walked into somebody's office and saw a pencil clip propeller. Can you describe what you saw and how that eventually turned into this giant project that we know as the Tower of the Four Winds?
Sure. The gentleman's name was Wayfield Rogers. He was an assistant animator. and I was doing in-betweens for him, and I went into his office one. Of course, I was always fascinated with kinetic sculpture. Anyway, little things that moved. And I went into his office one day, and on the lamp that was over his desk, he had a little kneaded eraser, and he had a push pin put in it, and then he made a little paper clip. Not a paper clip, but he made a little clip on it that was a little spinning propeller. And I was totally fascinated by it. And I said, Wafel, how did you do that? And he said, I can't tell you, it's a secret. So I said, oh, okay. So I went back. I did know that the clip he was using was a clip that held the erasers in the Blackwing pencil. So I went through so many goddamn pencils trying to get that propeller to work. And I couldn't get it to work because I was using a nail to make the dent. And a nail was not what you're supposed to use to make the dent. I didn't know that at the time. So after driving Wafel crazy for about a month, he finally says, I'll tell you what, I'll sell it to you. So I actually bought that propeller from him for a penny. He sold it to me for a penny. And then I said, okay, now that I own the propeller, tell me the secret. He says, the secret is to use a ballpoint pen to make the dent, because that's a smooth, curved surface that rides on the pushpin. And all these, prior to that, I was using nails. Well, nails would just cause little creases in it, and then your pushpin would get stuck in the creases. So I got that, and I was so proud of it that I decided to make a helicopter out of it. And the nice thing about it was, when you were in animation, we had tremendous air conditioning. And if you held the propeller up next to the wall, you'd get the propeller to spin like crazy.
Nice.
So I built a little cardboard, helicopter with this little propeller going. Well, one of the kids from the art props department said, geez, Willie, that's kind of neat. How'd you do that? I says, I'll tell you. I won't sell it to you. I'll tell you. So I told him, and then a few days later, he says, I made one. I said, you did? He says, come on and take a look at it. Well, what he did was he had taken the little clip and he cut out some circular little out of colored paper and glued them onto the clip. And so his propeller was bigger than mine, and that was very disturbing. So I decided, well, Jesus Christ, if you can make them like that, then I'll do that. So then I started building all these damn propellers and filling my room with them. And I had more goddamn fun doing that. You can't believe it. In fact, the other animator that I was in a room with got real intrigued by it, so he started helping me build propellers at the same time. So I ended up with about 30 propellers in my room.
That's great.
And the interesting thing about it was, a friend of mine, T.E., who was a guy that worked with Walt way, way back when, he says, you know, Rolly, you should have those propellers in the studio library, because the library was where guys could come and put their paintings in, have little art shows, and sell their paintings. So I said, oh, okay. So I signed up to have my propellers, some of my artwork, and some of the mosaics I did, as well as a mobile I did. So I had this little show with all my propellers in it. In fact, I have an 8mm film of that show.
Oh, and it's wow.
It's in my little film that they're doing, that they did on me. So it's kind of neat.
Cool. Is that about the time you started doing the painted rocks?
Oh, yes, it was. I was doing everything that everybody else was doing. I think that was the thing that was so beautiful. Walt asked me one time, he said, where do you get all your ideas? And I said, from you, sir. He said, what do you mean? I said, every room that I'm in with different guys, I learn from them. And one of the rooms I was in with this one fellow, he was painting on rocks. So I said, shit, I got to paint on rocks too. So I did everything I could and learned everything I could from the guys I worked with in animation.
And you just mentioned that whenever you were with somebody, you tried to learn from them. Was it true that at one point when you were in a meeting with Walt and other Imagineers, that for almost 3 years you said nothing because all you wanted to do was observe him?
Yeah, I just wanted to listen to him. You know what was interesting? He, when you first meet him, he's so damn powerful when he walks in the door. You don't want to say anything. You want to go out the door. And he's not like that at all. He turned out to be just a sweetheart of a guy to work with. But when you've never worked with him before, he was Walt Disney. And it was a little bit spooky at that time. So I'd say the first 2 to 3 years, I didn't say a word. But what I did do was I did notice the body language of all the other guys that were in the room. And I did notice that some of the guys were always singing and dancing for Walt, and I didn't think that what they were doing was too cool. But I look at Walt, and Walt was accepting it, and I thought, God, this is incredible that he should say, what the hell are you talking about? No, he didn't. He loved his guys, and he knew that no matter if a guy made a dumb statement, some of the other guys in the meeting would pick up that statement and do something with it. So it was a beautiful process to learn how to learn from other people.
It seems like you were very matter-of-fact with Walt, and just in general, you were a very matter-of-fact person. Was there anybody else there that could be as direct with Walt and not put on the show that you were talking about right now?
No. There was the guys that had worked with Walt for 20 years, but they still had so much respect for him, and they were very careful in what they said. So they were very cautious with him. But I, for some reason, felt very comfortable with him once I started, you know, entering into the conversations, which took a while. And then it got to the point to where after a meeting, I want to make sure that I understood what he said. And so I started sitting right next to him, and just to make sure that I'd understand that. And when the meeting was over with, sometimes I'd always grab his coat or his sleeve and say, Walt, sorry, I want to apologize for this, but really, what is the direction that we're trying to go here? And he'd sit there and turn to me and say, Rolly, he said, now, this is kind of what I have in mind. And he'd take the time to be real sweet and take me through it. And I was always real thrilled because the other guys had already left the room. And then sometimes he'd say, shit, I don't know. So it was one of those things that he was very honest with me, and I was very honest with him.
And was that honesty part of what you described as Walt's magic charm?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
When you originally moved over to WED from the animation department and you started working on these projects, what was the biggest shift in working mentality that you ended up dealing with?
Well, the interesting thing about it was I had already been aware of WED because I used to hang out at the model shop. And that's what WED was. WED was where Walt designed and came up with everything because he had to see him in models. And I used to kind of hang out there. So I got a feel for the going being in the model shop and knowing what he wanted. So I already had a feel for that when I went to WED. But the greatest story of all about going to WED was the fellow that was the head of animation department at that time called me in and said, would you like to go to work for WED? And I said, oh, God, yes, because I'd been thrilled. I really knew that animation was not my end for me to do that. I had no desire to be an animator, but I did have the desire to be a designer. So I said, sure. Well, the fellow that said that they were going to move me to WED said, you know, Roland, he says, you must have been a diamond in the rough because you had the worst portfolio of anyone that was ever hired in animation. And I thought, well, okay, that's okay. That doesn't bother me. At least I got the friggin' job.
Yes, there's hope for me yet.
Yeah.
When you were working at WED, what would you describe the work process as, and what was the average time to design attractions?
Well, first of all, you did whatever you were told to do, and I never knew what the hell they were going to tell me to do. And the good news is John Hinch, the head art director, and I got along real well. And anytime I was asked to do something and I didn't have a clue what to do, I went to John. I said, John, what do I do? And so John really taught me the formula. First of all, you do your homework. You get to understand the subject of whatever it is you're going to do, and you take it from there. And so I had him as a mentor, and it was so beautiful because I think I was the only one that ever went to John, because nobody would go to John and say, what do I do? Everybody had to pretend like they knew what they were doing. And in most cases, they didn't. But they were afraid to say that. You know what I mean? And I was just a dumb kid that said, shit, I want to know what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah, it's funny. You see that in today's workplace a lot. I've seen it for years where people are just afraid, and then projects just get prolonged for months and months when if people did what you did and just went and asked one question, what is this supposed to be? You get a clear vision of where you're supposed to be going.
Well, I learned so much. You know, first of all, getting back to learning from Walt, sitting in those meetings with Walt for like 2 or 3 years and not saying anything, I listened to every damn thing that was said. And the one thing I learned more than anything else from Walt was the big picture. He knew the big picture. He knew what the project was going to look like when it was finished, when we hadn't even started it. And I think the Tiki Room is a good example of it. He knew exactly what the Tiki Room was going to be. And we're sitting there looking at each other and we're saying, oh, little birds are going to chirp to birds, you know. And the next thing we know, a couple months later, we've got the bird. We did the Enchanted Tiki Room. We did it in 3 months.
In 3 months? Is that the fastest an attraction's ever been designed?
Yeah. But that was because when you're working with Walt, whatever the decisions were made by Walt, you went straight ahead. So there was nobody saying, well, let's take another look at that, or I'm not too sure about this. No, if Walt was there, it went just as smooth as glass.
Wow. I can't imagine just from concept to design to execution in 90 days, putting together an entire attraction, which originally started as a restaurant, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you take a look at Small World. We designed and built the whole goddamn thing in a stall at the World's Fair in 6 months.
Ooh.
I mean, stop it. Nothing's ever been done of that size and scope since then.
It's such a large project, and it was something brand new that hadn't been done before, which is mind-boggling. So let's talk a little bit about the World's Fair. When you were working there, you got a chance to work on, like you said, It's a Small World, which you worked on with Mark Davis and Mary Blair. You designed the Tower of the Four Winds, and you even had a chance to work at the Ford Pavilion with Bob Gurr. Tell us a little bit about the craziness of designing things for the World's Fair.
Well, it was, again, we were working on no time frames. We had to get stuff done immediately. And because of that, the freedom of design was incredible. I mean, whatever you came up with and Walt went along with it, you built the goddamn thing. So, I mean, it was an incredible time to work. And the World's Fair was a good example. And none of us knew that whatever we were doing for the World's Fair was going to be brought back and put into Disneyland. Walt knew that, but he never told us. So it was kind of a crazy time frame. I actually designed and built all the toys that were there. And there was only over 300 of them. And I had never done anything like that before in my life. And I don't know, I came up with the idea that they should be paper mache. So Jack Fergus, another fellow, and I, and a little gal, we started making the toys. And probably within, I'd say, 2 or 3 weeks, we had 30 people building all those toys.
Whoa.
Under those parameters of doing it like paper mache.
Wow. Can you tell us a little bit about the gag that some of the other workers played on you guys with the boats on It's a Small World?
Yeah, we had other people did gags on us. Yeah, we came to work one day, and they'd gone over to the Kodak Pavilion that had this little pond with all these koi fish in it. And they took the koi fish out and put it in our trough. And so when we came to work, there was all these koi fish swimming around in the trough. And then they got those out of there. And the next morning we came in and they put super suds into the trough. And so we had soap foam that was probably 4 feet high going throughout the entire ride. So
when you were on It's a Small World, you had a chance to work with Mary Blair. And you actually stayed with her while you were in New York, correct?
Yeah.
Describe Mary Blair and just your time with her for a little bit.
Well, this is a 2-hour answer. I mean, I'm going to try to edit it down. First of all, you have to understand something. When I was in animation, I'd seen Mary's work in the backgrounds at different parts of animation. And I was very much aware of Mary. And I fell madly in love with her and her style because she was very stylized. Everything she did was stylized. And as there was a term that we used to use in animation called moldy fig. And moldy fig came from Ward Kimball. Moldy fig meant drawing them like Snow White's, or like, you know, the other animated films that we were doing back in the 30s. And so Mary's style was far more contemporary than that. And so she was not Moldy Fig. And so it was interesting because Walt loved her, and he loved her style because it was fresh and it was new and it was colorful. So I fell in love with all of that. And then when I found out I was going to work with her, I just thought I died and gone to heaven. I couldn't believe it because she worked with paint right out of the tube, and that's the way I worked. I worked with straight colors. I didn't mix my paint, or she didn't mix her with white or black or anything else. No, no, it was just straight out of the tube.
Wow.
So she and I got along just great. We had a good time. She had a great sense of humor. She had great stories to tell me, because she used to tell me stories about Walt clear back in the 30s and what it was like for her growing up in the studio.
Wow. I remember reading a story, and I have to ask you, are you a fan of magic?
Oh, yes, I am. By the way, yeah.
What is your favorite type of magic?
Well, I started learning magic when I was 9 years old. A kid from across the street was a little guy studying to be a magician, and he used to call me over when I was 9 and say, I got to show you this latest trick. So I fell madly in love with magic, and it's always been my hobby. In fact, I still have a lot of the magic I did when I was in high school.
Wow.
I still have all that stuff.
The reason I brought it up was because in the book you mentioned that you had sat down and you were teaching Mary Blair's boys some magic tricks while you were there.
Oh, yes. Well, I stayed with Mary and her family for 2 or 3 nights once when I was living back there during the fair. And her two sons, we were sitting after dinner on the floor, and I got a deck of cards out, and I started showing the boys magic, and they fell madly in love with it. Well, it turned out I spent about 3 hours with Oak's kids teaching the magic, and Mary said that they absolutely loved it. They thought that, she said, you spent more time with my sons than anybody else. She said, I really appreciate that.
Wow. What was your favorite type, coin magic, card magic?
Probably card. I ended up, spending a lot of time with the cards. I think the one thing that this gets back to the way I design, I learned that when you did a card trick, it was good to do a card trick, but how can you take that card trick to the next level? Like you pick a card, you bring it back, and then you say, no, pick 2 cards. No, pick 3 cards. So I was always taking one step higher with whatever I was learning, and the same thing was happened with my designs. I always try to go way beyond, always up the ladder.
Yeah, it's funny. Growing up, I was always a huge fan of magic as well. And in the last 15 years, I was such a huge fan that I started trying to perform it as well. So alongside all these Disney history books, I probably have about 60 to 75 magic books that were written by Di Vernon and Scarny and all these magicians from back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. Card magic was my favorite as well. So maybe if I get a chance to see you in person one day, maybe we can go back and forth with some card tricks.
Yeah.
You haven't done it in a while.
Yeah, no, I haven't. No, I haven't. I think one of the best magic shows I ever gave was I was working with the Sultan of Oman designing a show that went into his fort in Fort Jalali in Oman. And I was working for this very, very wealthy man that hired me to design this show for them in the fort. And so we were sitting at the dinner table one night. There was like 30 of us. And the night before, I'd spent with one of the gentlemen that worked there. And I had shown his, he had kind of a good friend that he brought over. And so I showed him some card tricks. And so this fellow said at the dinner table that night when we were having the big dinner, he says, you know, if you're really good, Roy will show you some card tricks after dinner. And I thought, what the hell is he talking about? I mean, you know, he's just trying to be a wise ass. Well, anyway, what happened was we all had to leave and go to the beach. We got down to the beach, and there was this huge, big series of carpets and pillows and everything. And there was, there must have been about 20 of us. That was secretaries and different people that worked in the government for him. But right in the middle of it was 2 decks of cards. And I thought, oh, yeah. You know, and I'd been drinking like crazy. I mean, I was half ripped. And I thought, oh, my God, I've got to do card tricks. Well, the one thing I learned a long time ago is when you're going to do card tricks, for people that you don't know, the first thing you do is when you go to shuffle the cards, you spin them all over the room. So it looks like you don't have a clue what you're doing. And that's what I did. Well, everybody started laughing, like, oh, my God, he's going to show us the card trick. And then I did the best card trick I've ever known that I learned a long time ago, and that shut them all up. So then I went for about an hour. I used to go for an hour on card tricks. And the next day, Dr. Zawawi, who had that dinner, came up, and he came over to me. He says, oh, by the way, Roland, he said, my secretary really liked your card tricks. So my thank you was my secretary liked your card tricks.
Well, I guess it all worked out in the end, right?
Yes, it does.
You ended up leaving the Disney company in 1970. And at that point, you had a chance to work on some other major theme parks. You got to work at Busch Gardens, the Ringling Brothers Circus World, and you even designed Knott's Berry Tales at Knott's Berry Farm here in Buena Park.
Yeah.
What was that like, moving away from Disney and doing these other projects on your own?
Well, I think working for Disney and doing what you did gave you a tremendous amount of confidence. For some reason, I learned the confidence from working with them and all the different people. So I wasn't afraid of anything. You know, I was fearless. And so when I got a chance to do the Berry Tales, there was a lot of ideas that I had come up with that they wouldn't accept at Disney. They believed that if you did a dark ride, it had to be done in UV lighting. I kept wanting to add incandescent lighting, and they said, no. It's all it's all black light. And so I thought, oh, okay. Well, when I did the Berry Tales, I mixed UV lighting and the black light, and I actually proved that it really worked beautifully. So I was very proud of all the things that I had learned that I got a chance to do that I hadn't done before. So that was great. I had a ball doing the Berry Tales.
Did you, knowing that you had created this Museum of the Weird years before that unfortunately never actually saw itself as an attraction, did you ever think about building something like that on your own? Or was it just as the projects came up for you?
No, not on my own, not at all. That's left for somebody else to do.
Okay. From all the stuff that you've worked on, what would you say your favorite project has been?
My favorite project? Well, this is beautiful. I think it probably boils down to the Tower of the Four Winds, because like Marie said, it's the one thing that you did that wasn't Disney. It was something that you created, and it came from that stupid little propeller. So I think the best thing I ever did was the Tower of the Four Winds.
I remember you had talked a little bit about how when you first saw the tower, you didn't like it at all. Oh,
yeah.
Why didn't you like it? What ended up happening?
Well, basically, that's another kind of a long story. I built a model, a half-inch-scale model of the tower, and that model was sent down to the engineers, and then they engineered it, and they designed the one that got built. And, of course, mine was very delicate, and when I got the chance to see the finished one, everything had gotten fat. Things that were like 6 inches in diameter became 16 inches in diameter. So when I first looked at it, I just thought, geez, this is a piece of crap. And that's when Walt came. I had to drive Walt down to take a look at this thing, this tower. And Walt turned to me and says, well, he says, what do you think? And I said, I think it's a piece of crap. Now, who tells Walt Disney that what they design is a piece of crap? Well, that just shows you the relationship that he and I had. And he was so cute because it can't be a piece of crap, really. It cost me $200,000. But he knew exactly where I was coming from. And he says, you know, Roly, when these things take place, you have to support the people that are going to build it. So he was really sweet with me because he knew why I was pissed off. And so by the time he and I got finished talking, I said to him, yeah, I think it's good. I think it's okay. You
know? Do you still kind of tinker around and build things on your spare time?
No. No, I'd like to drink a little once in a while. We have a glass of wine every night.
Do you tinker with and build things?
No, I don't tinker. I was trying to be funny.
Okay.
I got it. I appreciated it.
He got it.
Well, I thought he misunderstood.
No. I got it. We do the same thing. We start off every podcast with beer, so.
I thought you said, do you like to sit around and drink?
No, I knew what he said about tinkering.
When you were working on Berry Tales, Rolly, was it your own company that you started? Because you kind of turned it into a family affair, right? You brought in your son and everybody to work on it?
Yeah.
What was it like having your own company to do that?
I've always enjoyed my own companies. I've had them two or three times, and I love them.
How was it like for you knowing when your son Chris was offered to work as an Imagineer and following your footsteps?
I thought it was great. You have to understand something. That poor kid had to grow up underneath me, not only as my son, but as the things that he'd like to do to please me and things I like to do to please him. So we had a beautiful relationship. I remember when he was just a little guy and he liked to make models. I used to go out and buy models for him all the time because I wanted to get him perpetuated like my mom did. So if he was interested in building models, I wanted him to build models. So I had him building models all the time. Now, there's a cute story behind that. I bought him a model one time. It was a little hot rod car. And he gave me he got to the instructions and didn't quite understand them. Well, giving it to me, I didn't understand a damn word of it. Well, Jack Fergus that we worked with was a beautiful model builder. And so Chris would say, why don't you take the plans to beg Jack and have him tell you what we're supposed to do. So I went the next day and I said, Jack, for God's sake, tell me what this damn print says. So he read it and then he explained it to me. And then he wrote a little note to Chris. So then I became sort of a mailman between Big Jack and my son about passing these questions back and forth.
Well, at least you had some kind of instruction, because have you ever tried to build something from IKEA? It's the worst experience ever.
IKEA.
No, God, no.
It's the worst experience ever. At least you had a translator, right?
Yeah. His dad did all that. So, but you know, everything I ever designed for Disney was built from a model that I built. So I was a model builder for all the things that I designed for Disney. So that was the formula. Walt wanted to see everything in model before he would go ahead with it. So I do know that there was what we used to do were called quick and dirty models. And that was just to show Walt the volume of something. And I know I did a quick and dirty little model of a building outside of Small World that was by the Bank of America, telling, you know, what the Bank of America is all about. And I was giving the presentation to Walt about where this went. It was just a little cardboard box. And the head engineer turned to Walt and he says, you know, Walt, he says, it doesn't look too sturdy to me. And he turned to John and says, John, he says, we're not going to make it out of cardboard. So this is a good time.
That's awesome.
I've heard that story so many times.
Yeah.
Funny.
Just how somebody could think that it's going to be cardboard just kind of blows you up in your head. Yeah. So in 1996, you ended up just officially retiring and moving on. And then in 2004 is when Disney bestowed you with the honor of being a Disney legend.
Yes.
How was that presented to you, and what went through your mind when this came up?
Well, I got a letter in the mail about wanting me to get an award. And I thought, shit, I don't want any awards. I didn't want to go. And my son really got upset with me. He says, you got to go, Dad. And I said, I do. And he said, yes. And Marie said the same thing. God damn it, Roland, you're going to go.
I did not.
No, I know. I'm just teasing him. I have to tease with her. I have to make sure she's listening to what I'm saying. Anyway, so we went. And it probably was one of the highlights of my life to be able to stand up there and get a Legend Award, because I'll be honest with you, I didn't believe I had earned one. I remember all the people I worked with and everything. Said, why the hell did they pick me? Well, it hasn't been since I've gone back and looked at everything that I've really done. And I thought, oh, yeah, I do deserve it.
If it means anything, I do believe that you deserve it. I know that it's many years after you got it, but every day that I walk into my office, Rolly, I don't know if you remember, but a couple of years ago, I met you in person for the first time. It was at the signing that we did, or that we did, like I was involved, that you had at Beach Ball Comics for the Seekers of the Weird comic book that came out. And I remember I showed you this picture of your window, and yeah. you signed it for me, and it's on my wall. And every day that I walk in, you are one of the people, at least your name is what I look like. It's one of the things that drives me and inspires me to continue doing and just keep going with what my ultimate goals are. So not just with what you did for Disney, but just how many people you've inspired. You know, I just want to say thank you, because everything that you've done has touched a lot of us.
Yeah, we get letters from from people every week telling us how I've touched them, and I haven't a clue how I touched them. I just did a job, you know, and I was in love with it. And I think the thing that they really read for me is how much I really cared about what I did, and that I was very proud of it in my own way. So it's kind of hard. I don't like to have an ego, but once in a while I have to say, shit, Rolly, you were damn good.
So if you could offer any advice for anybody that's just trying to follow their dreams, do what they want to do, and not settle for the status quo, what would you say to those people right now?
Yeah, well, the advice is probably the same thing that my mom would say. You just got to believe in what you're going to do. And the one thing that is kind of interesting, always believe in your crazy ideas and always color outside the lines. That was my philosophy in everything that I did. And I think if you take that approach, no matter what business you want to get into, I think that's going to be a good little formula to work to.
That's awesome. Thank you for that. All right. Well, for everybody listening right now, I hope you've enjoyed our time talking with Rolly today. His book is called It's Kind of a Cute Story, and he wrote it with our good pal Jeff Heimbuch. So if you have not picked up the book, there will be a link to the Amazon ordering page for that. It is a wonderful, wonderful book with tons of stories about Rolly and working at WED, growing up, all that stuff. And I'm also going to put a link for all of the supplemental audio that he did, because he had More Cute Stories, volumes 1-6, where he talks from the Imagineers that he worked with all the way to working at Knott's Berry Farm. And those were amazing to listen to as well.
Okay, good. So, well, I love talking about all this good stuff. And I think the thing is, I'm just kind of honest, and it just kind of comes out the way it's supposed to. So, you know, you just have to be yourself.
Yeah. Well, Rolly, I really appreciate yours and Marie's time today. I just, again, I want to say thanks, because I'm just very thankful that I got a chance to talk to you today.
Well, you're very welcome, Hazen. And when you sent your picture, we did remember for sure about the book signing.
Oh, right? I'm glad.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I remember it well. So thank you.
I really enjoyed it. It was a good time today.
Well, I hope we get a chance to do it again soon.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Hazen.
Well, thanks again. Thank you. You guys have a great afternoon.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. That is going to be it for this episode. I hope you guys enjoyed this chat that I had with Rolly. I was super thankful that we weren't able to meet in person, but they were gracious enough. He and Marie were gracious enough to, you know, set up this phone conversation with him. And yeah, there was so many things that I wanted to touch on that I didn't get a chance to, but I wanted to be respectful of Rolly's time, and hopefully we get a chance to do this again soon. I had a lot of fun, and maybe next time we can bring up some of the other stuff, like the Museum of the Weird. That was one thing that I wanted to bring up a little bit more, so he can talk a little bit more about that. But again, you know, hopefully another time we'll get a chance to get into that. But I mentioned it just a bit ago. Check out the book. Check out the audio file. All the links are going to be in the blog post for the episode. Check it out. He produced them all with Jeff. And Jeff did an amazing job of compiling these stories and just putting this audio out. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to them, pick up a copy. They're available on Amazon and CD Baby. So the links will be up. But definitely get It's Kind of a Cute Story. It's just a treasure trove of stories. So that's going to wrap it up for this episode, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed this chat with Rolly. Until next week, Here is to beers, cheers, and make it yours. Have a fantastic week, everybody.